Chapter 30. And so our peculiar little band of adventurers made our way to the Sudbury Hotel. We had taken a few moments to wash and make ourselves presentable, but there was only so much one could do about the bruises and visible wounds. Stoker's chest was so thickly wrapped, he seemed to be wearing a breastplate of bandages, and one eye was blooming into a spectacular bruise of violet and mauve. He had donned his eye patch, a sure sign that his sight was fatigued, and I saw fresh lines at the corners of his mouth. As for me, the cut on my cheek was still vivid scarlet and inclined to drip onto my clothes. I dressed in a two-piece ensemble of heavy black silk. It fastened smartly up the front with a row of tiny buttons that led to a narrow-fitted collar, neatly concealing the wound Mrs. McGregor had inflicted upon my throat. The ensemble was appropriately sober for the occasion, and I had instructed the dressmaker to include wide, hidden pockets inside the seams of the skirt. Into these I slipped a few of my favourite weapons, and one or two new finds, including the cheese wire. Stoker stared as I patted it into place.
"Do you really plan on garrotting someone in the Sudbury?"
he asked pleasantly. "One can never anticipate when one will be forced to garrot," I informed him as I pinned my hat into place. I favoured wide brims when I butterflied, but in town I preferred smaller confections, wisps of feathers or flowers to suggest a head covering. But on a whim, I had asked the dressmaker to fashion a sort of soft cap of the silk left from sewing the dress. The result was a type of tam-o'-shanter, the headwear much favoured by the Celt. To the narrow band I had pinned a small feather, and the effect was jaunty. I looked like the sort of woman who could keep her composure in difficult circumstances, I decided. There was nothing frivolous or unserious about my costume. Even the feather was narrow and stiff. No voluptuous plumes or lacy ruffles for me. Harry dressed in a suit borrowed from Stoker, artfully pinned to hide the extra length. He had padded out the extra breadth with a bit of stuffing, arranging it to appear as though he had a comfortable and prosperous belly, rather than Stoker's admirably developed musculature. He stood with rounded shoulders, and the effect was to make him appear older and shorter. But the greatest change was in his face. I poked the ginger hair glued to his face with a tentative finger. "Where on earth did you find that set of moustaches?" I inquired.
"I took a leaf from Stoker's book and searched the costume boxes," he informed me happily. "I have decided it is far safer to go about in disguise until I am able to take my leave of London."
"It looks as if you skinned a gnome," I told him, "and those moustaches do not even match your hair." He smoothed his moustaches and pulled his cap low.
"Do not touch what you cannot appreciate," he said loftily. "I intend to present myself as an Irishman visiting London on matters of business," he added, in a nearly impenetrable brogue.
"Heaven help us all," I muttered. In spite of the lavish red moustaches, we looked, from a distance, like a perfectly respectable trio. Up close, we were disreputable as pirates, and I could only hope we would not frighten the Maharani. We rode in silence to the Sudbury, none of us inclined to conversation. It had, after all, been an exceedingly long and tiring day, but none of us would rest easily until the diamond was safely in the Maharani's possession. I could not know what thoughts occupied Stoker's mind, but I was considering Harry's contradictory actions. He had conspired with Mrs. McGregor, but he had returned to help us escape. For every stroke of red I lettered in his ledger, I must, in fairness, add one in black. It was a distinctly unsettling experience to think anything but the worst of him, and I was not pleased at the ambiguity. I had long ago put him firmly in the category of villain, and it was unreasonable of him to try to weasel out of it. Such were my thoughts as we drew up in front of the hotel. In spite of the lateness of the hour, the Beau Monde was just beginning its pleasures. The hotel was ablaze with artificial lights, and the lobby was thronged with people, most dressed far more grandly than we. The women bedecked in satin, with perfumed and powdered décolletages, draped with jewels, whilst the men fussed with their satin-lined capes and pearl tie-pins. We garnered one or two curious looks from the more fashionable, but I ignored them, striding through the crowd and directly to the front desk. The night manager, a fellow I did not know, was standing with an expectant expression, his moustaches neatly waxed, his shirt front starched to perfection.
"How may I be of service, madam?"
he inquired in a low voice. "I wish to see the Maharani of Viratanagar," I replied. He blinked.
"I am sorry, madam, but there is no guest by that name in this hotel."
I opened my mouth to contradict him, but Stoker clasped my hand. I remembered then what Julien had told us about the Maharani's insistence upon privacy. After her photograph had been published in the Daily Harbinger, she had instructed hotel staff to preserve her incognita. "Blast," I muttered, turning to Stoker. "What was her nom d'hôtel?" He shrugged, and I sighed as I turned back to the manager. "We know she is here, my good man. Now kindly send up a note that I will write, and..." The manager held up a hand.
"Madam, I cannot send up a note to a guest who is not registered in this hotel."
His voice was reasonable, the sort of overly patient tone one uses with difficult children or people of dubious intelligence. Stoker plucked a coin from his pocket and slid it across the desk.
"Perhaps you can carry the note up now,"
he suggested, with the cool hauteur of a viscount's son. The manager swept the shiny guinea from the desk and into his pocket with a practiced gesture.
"Thank you, sir. And I repeat, I cannot send up a note to a guest who is not registered in this hotel."
"Then you owe us a guinea," I muttered. His expression was grave.
"I am sorry I cannot accommodate your request, madam, but I am afraid I have other matters to which I must presently attend."
He inclined his head as a gesture of dismissal, after which he simply stood, looking vacant. My fingers reached for my garrote wire, but Stoker grabbed my hand and pulled me away from the desk and behind a potted palm, Harry following meekly behind.
"Veronica, for the love of all that is holy and good, tell me you were not actually intending to take out your cheese wire."
"Cheese wire?"
Harry's voice rose in disbelief.
"She carries it in case she is called upon to garrote someone,"
Stoker explained. "I did not intend to harm him," I said sulkily, "but I thought the sight of it might prove persuasive."
"If we manage to get through this night without finding ourselves in the cells at Scotland Yard, it will be God's own miracle,"
Stoker said through gritted teeth. Suddenly, he seemed seized by an idea. He jerked his head towards the door leading to the hotel's inner offices. "Julien will be long gone by this hour," I told him.
"Exactly," he said, leading the way.
Concealed by the bustle of the crowd, we slipped through the door and hurried downstairs. Hotel staff, accustomed to odd comings and goings, did not give us a second look. The pastry kitchen was dark, scrubbed clean and ready for the following day. On a hook behind the door hung one of Julien's white coats, which Stoker buttoned over his own. A tray of prettily arranged petit four, no doubt at hand should any guest ring in the night for a bit of sustenance, lay on a table, and he took it up.
There is my disguise,
he said, in some satisfaction as he turned to me.
Where is yours?
I cast my eye around the room and found only a stack of clean towels. I tied one at my waist to approximate an apron and grabbed an enormous whisk, some 2 feet long. We were rummaging for another coat for Harry when we heard footsteps approaching.
In here,
Harry urged, holding open a door. We dove inside, and Harry closed the door after us. We were in a room lined with shelves, each one stacked high with pristine white sheets and towels, the air heavily scented with the odours of starch and clean linen. Stoker laid a finger over his lips and we held our breath, waiting for the footsteps to pass. But they did not pass. Instead, they stopped just outside and the door was yanked open. What the devil? The woman outside had no chance to finish. Stoker reached out and jerked her inside, while Harry once more closed the door. JJ, I said, sagging in relief.
You know this chambermaid?
Harry asked, surveying her from starched white mob cap to stiff bombazine skirts. She gave a sniff. I am not a chambermaid. I am a journalist, she corrected loftily. And who are you?
Henry Trismegistus Spenlove,
he said, sweeping her a bow. Your second name is not Trismegistus, I hissed.
No, but I don't much care for Walter. I thought I might try something new, he replied.
Stoker sighed.
JJ, we are in need of assistance,
he began. So I deduced, she said, a thoroughly mercenary light in her eyes.
We need an audience with the Maharani of Viratanagar,
he explained. And your manager is most unhelpful, I put in. I can get you in, she told us, but it will cost. JJ, really? I remonstrated. I thought we were friends. She held up a hand. Friends keep other friends' secrets, she said, with a meaningful look, which I have done, and now friends can help friends get a story.
That is a convoluted statement,
Stoker told her. She bared her teeth in something that was not quite a smile. And yet you understood me. We did, I told her. I sighed. She was entirely correct. JJ had learnt the truth of my parentage some months back, and although the story would have been the making of her career, she would, in short, have gone down as nothing less than a journalistic legend had she published it. She had said nothing, in print or otherwise, to betray me. Furthermore, when she discovered I was masquerading as Her Royal Highness, the Hereditary Princess of the Alpenwald, she had asked for comparatively little to keep her silence.
Very well,
Stoker said.
We will give you a story. You can print nothing of the Maharani and our business here tonight, but I swear we will give you something worth your while. Do I have your word that you will keep quiet with what you are about to hear?
My word, she said, putting out her hand to shake. Stoker took hers soberly as she jerked her head towards Harry. Who is he, really? A thief and a confidence trickster, I said. Harry reared indignantly.
That is mighty rude, considering,
he protested. What business has a confidence trickster with the Maharani of Viratanagar? She asked. None that you may print, I told her firmly. But we have something far more interesting for your readers, I assured her. She gave me a narrow look, then fetched an armful of towels for Harry to carry. Hide your face with these and follow, she ordered. She took a look at my disguise and snorted. Speak to no one and keep your eyes down, she instructed me. She poked her head out of the linen room to make certain the corridor was clear before beckoning to us. Walk fast and stay close. Unlike the older hotels, where the most august suites were located at the bottom, the Sudbury had been built with lifts, allowing them to give the higher floors over to luxurious rooms far from the bustle of the street and lobby. Everything was hushed here, courtesy of the thick carpets that stretched from wall to wall. Staff spoke only in whispers on these floors, and the air smelt of privilege.
Which suite?
Stoker asked, as he moved down the corridor. The Empress suite, JJ informed us. Here. We stopped in front of the door, a tiny brass plaque proclaiming the name of the suite in elegant script. An empty chair sat outside, and JJ grinned. The Maharani's bodyguard has a torn dress for one of the other maids. She finishes work at 11, and he always slips off to see her.
Rather slipshod if he is supposed to be protecting her, Harry put in.
JJ rolled her eyes. There are half a dozen plainclothes detectives in the lobby at any given hour. This fellow is ceremonial. JJ rapped sharply, and the rest of us gathered behind her. The door opened almost at once, and I peered under Stoker's arm to see that it was our intruder from the previous night. He looked at Stoker's chef's coat and the tray of pastries, as well as Harry's stack of towels.
We ordered nothing,
he said, shutting the door. Stoker put out his foot, catching the door before it closed, just as I stepped out from behind him. The young man's eyes widened in shock. I smiled to put him at his ease, but he let loose a string of words in a language I did not speak and turned, fleeing into the suite as if all the devils from hell were hard upon his heels. We entered and closed the door. The foyer of the suite was furnished with a heavy walnut table carved with assorted fruits and animals. Stoker left his tray of pastries there, not without a longing look at a cream horn, and dropped his chef's coat beside it. We saw ourselves into the sitting room, where our intruder stood in front of a seated woman, his legs spread in a warrior's stance, a sword held aloft in his hand. He was clearly prepared to die in defence of the lady, and I smiled, recognising her at once. I am sorry, I do not know the correct way to address a Maharani, I told her. She raised her hand to stem the flow of chatter from her grandson and gave me an amused look.
You should not address me at all until you are spoken to, but I do not expect you to know such things.
The Maharani was dressed in the same style of ensemble she had worn in her photograph. Beautifully draped silks, heavy with embroidery. Her hair, thick and black with only a few threads of silver, was coiled at her neck, and she wore a parure of gold jewellery set with enormous gems. Her grandson was also dressed in traditional clothing, with a long silk coat over narrow trousers of the same material. He maintained his martial posture, and the meaning was clear. We might intrude, but we would never get near enough to harm his grandmother. The gesture was touching, although one look at the set of the Maharani's jaw told me she was a woman accustomed to looking after herself.
This is my grandson, Bhairav, and you may address me as Excellency or Madam, she said. Let us be casual together.
She made a brief signal, and her grandson lowered his sword, but kept a watchful eye upon us. We are sorry to intrude so abruptly, I told her, but I am afraid the manager at the front desk proved uncooperative to our request to announce us. Her smile was thin.
It is of little consequence. I know who you are.
She waved a hand towards the sofa opposite her, and Stoker and I sat, perching on the edge of the settee. Harry stood behind us, and I suspected JJ was still in the foyer, listening to every word.
Mr. Templeton Vane and Miss Speedwell, is it not?
And our associate, Mr. Spenlove, I told her. I must congratulate you on your sources, I said. The smile deepened.
I have friends in your government, discreet friends who sympathize with my politics.
With independence for India, you mean?
Stoker inquired.
Self-rule,
her grandson corrected sharply.
We are dependent upon no one.
I meant no offense,
Stoker replied, careful to keep his voice neutral. There was a cut high upon the young man's cheek, marring the smooth perfection of his skin. I am sorry for that, I said, nodding towards the injury. If I had known who you were, I would have been perfectly happy to hand over what you came for. He snorted, and his grandmother patted his hand, murmuring a few words in Hindi.
I do not ask you to excuse my grandson, she told us. His skepticism of Europeans is an honest result of the invasion and occupation of our country. I hope in time he will come to trust that we have some friends here, although not as many as I would like.
You may count us among them,
Stoker said boldly. She laughed, a strong, mirthful sound from low in her belly.
I am not surprised, Mr. Templeton Vane. Several of my meetings this week have been with a Sir Rupert Templeton Vane, a close connection of yours, I am told.
My elder brother,
Stoker said in obvious surprise.
But you astonish me. I knew he worked in some capacity for the Foreign Office. I was not aware he had a stake in the affairs of India.
She shrugged. At the beginning of the week, he was merely open to the possibility. Now he supports us, albeit quietly. I have asked him not to make his feelings known publicly. He can do far more for our cause by working from within. She tipped her head to one side. But I do not think you have come to discuss politics. She did nothing so vulgar as hold out her hand, but the intent was clear. Stoker reached into his pocket and withdrew one of his red bandana handkerchiefs. He had knotted it securely around the jewel, and he presented this to the Maharani.
An interesting choice, she said. Your bandana comes from India. Did you know that? We call the technique of dyeing it bandani. It came to this part of the world when there was a fashion for snuff. The habit left white handkerchiefs badly soiled with the stains of tobacco, so these patterned handkerchiefs from our country were the perfect solution. Of course, we make them in all colours, not just this turkey red, but it is possible the Englishman has a limited imagination. With deft fingers, she unknotted the cloth and folded it back to reveal the diamond's shimmering fire. Even in its humble wrapping, it was mesmerizing. The Maharani said nothing for a long moment, then touched it with a fingertip, her expression reverent.
It is just as I remember it, she said softly. Did you wear it? I asked. She nodded.
On my wedding day. The parure was a gift from my husband. It was stolen from us during the rebellion.
We suspected as much, Stoker told her. When Lady Hathaway spoke of how she acquired it, she was less than informative.
The Maharani gave a short laugh. No doubt. The Hathaways were staying with us when the rebellion broke out. My husband, the Maharaja,
and Sir Geoffrey worked closely together. They were friends, and the Hathaways often spent summers with us at our palace in the hills. My relationship with Lady Hathaway was not as close as that of our husbands, she said dryly. I found her badly educated and unsympathetic, but we were cordial. Our positions and our husbands demanded it. As the troubles began, the Hathaways decided to withdraw to the English fort for their own security. There was much confusion at the time, you understand, and so when the jewels went missing, there was no way to prove who had taken them. But I knew, she said.
How?
Stoker inquired. A woman knows when another woman wants something of hers, I replied. The Maharani inclined her head. Exactly so. The envy of a woman is not always easy to conceal. I had seen her eyes linger too often upon my jewels, and I confess I wore them constantly when she was in our home. I knew she had nothing to rival them, and it rankled her to see them around the neck of a woman she considered inferior.
She stole them,
her grandson burst out,
like a common thief.
But we could not prove it, the Maharani went on. I went to my husband with my suspicions, and he refused to broach the matter with the English government. He said matters were at a delicate pass, and we could not afford to bring trivialities into the mix.
Trivialities!
I exclaimed, looking at the diamond. It was a point of pride with him that he could afford to replace them, she said. I eyed the elaborate collar of emeralds and rubies at her throat. He certainly did, I remarked. This? Paste, she said, like all of my jewels. Everything he gave me has been sold to raise money for the cause in which we believe so passionately.
All of them? I gaped at her, looking from the heavy girandole earrings to the stacks of bracelets encircling her arms from wrist to elbow.
All, she said firmly. I would sacrifice everything to see my country free of English rule, even to the greatest of my jewels.
She patted her grandson's hand. Although I would prefer this one to take rather fewer risks.
You fuss too much,
Lord Bhairav said, ducking his head.
I was not harmed, and even if I were, it was a small price to pay to return the Eye of the Dawn to its rightful home.
He looked to us, and for the first time I saw humor in his dark gaze.
Have you worked it out yet? Our plan to restore the Eye of the Dawn?
Almost, I said slowly. Let us return to the theft of the jewels. They were taken during the mutiny by Lady Hathaway, who later brought them to England. The Maharaja refused to raise the matter with the English authorities in India, so she got away with them. But you never forgot they were your property, I said, nodding to the Maharani, and you raised your grandchildren with the story.
Grandchildren?
Stoker asked. Anjali, I told him. She is your granddaughter, is she not? I asked the Maharani. Sister or cousin to Lord Bhairav?
She is my sister,
he said.
How the devil, pardon me, Your Excellency,
Stoker said to the Maharani.
How the deuces did you figure that?
I gave him a narrow look. I had a little time to think whilst you were occupied with Mrs. McGregor. He blushed deeply, and I went on. And so the three of you concocted a plan. Anjali was to insinuate herself into the Hathaway household. That must have taken some effort.
Anjali was at school with Euphemia Hathaway,
Lord Bhairav said.
But Anjali is miles older,
Harry put in. Not if you look carefully, I corrected. She wears smoked spectacles, so you cannot see her eyes. The grey in her hair must be powder. I did not realize it at first, but when I considered it later, I realized what had been bothering me about her. I had detected an incongruity, and I could not, at Hathaway Hall, discover what it was. It was only when I had time to think that I hit upon the fact that, in spite of being told she was a person of some maturity, I recalled that she moved with the lightness and grace of a much younger woman.
Very clever, said a low voice from the doorway. Anjali,
I cried. It was she, although I am forced to admit that had I encountered her in her present state, I might not have immediately made the connection to the quiet dowd of Hathaway Hall. Her hair, freed of its dulling powder, shone rich and black as her brother's, and her eyes were bright and shining with youth without the mask of the smoked spectacles. She was dressed not as a wren in dull grey, but as a peacock in shifting blues and greens, the silks rippling as she moved into the room and took a chair next to her grandmother with a graceful gesture. She looked at the diamond in the Maharani's palm and gave a nod of satisfaction.
I must thank you for returning it to us, she said,
with an air of authority she had not sported in Devon. And I must apologize for the stratagems we employed. They were not meant to make you feel foolish or to alarm you. They had nothing to do with us at all, I suspect, I replied. She smiled.
You are correct, Miss Speedwell.
She looked with interest at Harry.
Your disguise is as imperfect as mine was. You are the man who claimed to be Jonathan Hathaway, and yet you are called Spenlove? Then you were engaging in an imposture of your own?
He had the grace to duck his head.
I am not Jonathan Hathaway,
he acknowledged.
But I knew Hathaway, and I can confirm he is, as his family feared, buried in Sumatra.
She pursed her lips.
To give them hope was a cruel thing to do, she said, with all the dignity and authority of her grandmother.
Harry bowed his head further still, and Anjali turned to Stoker and to me.
Ask what you like. You have earned it, I think.
I presume Euphemia Hathaway knew of your masquerade, Stoker put in.
Anjali nodded.
She did. The fact that we were at school together was a coincidence, you understand. But there are not many schools which provide the rigor of scientific education we both wanted. Effie's school fees were paid by her grandfather, who encouraged her studies. And her future seemed promising. She dreamt, we both did, of attending university, but a series of tragedies befell her family.
Jonathan Hathaway's death, I murmured. Anjali went on.
With the deaths of his son and grandson, Sir Geoffrey lost much of his vigor. He seemed to age overnight. He no longer studied the stars or guided Effie in her observations. It seemed as if his very will to live had been taken from him.
Effie must have known she would have a very different life with Charles as head of the family,
Stoker suggested.
She did. She lived in dread of the time he would inherit. Charles is not a monster,
Anjali clarified.
But what he is doing to her is monstrous. He has taken all from her that matters. Her studies, her passions. He allows his wife to reduce her to a shadow, less than a person. She is permitted nothing of her own, not a dream, not an ambition. He gives all control over to Mary Hathaway
and because she fears what people will say more than anything, she strives to break Effie's spirit, as one would break an unruly horse. It is an untenable situation. Mary Hathaway is the worst sort of provincial, I put in. We smiled at one another, bonded, as women frequently are, by our mutual dislike of another.
How did you come to conspire together to steal the jewels?
Stoker asked. She folded her hands primly in her lap. We discussed it often. I knew Lady Hathaway still had the diamond, but Effie said it was always locked away in a bank vault, and for all our cleverness, we could not imagine how we would break into a bank vault and steal it. She added, with a smile that revealed two deep dimples. But I pointed out to her it would be a very easy thing to take it if it were in Hathaway Hall. First, Effie suggested to Mary that Lady Hathaway needed a companion, and she mentioned that she knew of a gently born woman of Indian parentage who needed employment. A wry smile twisted her lips, and she went on. Mary Hathaway liked the idea of having Effie further under her thumb, and Effie would have more time for her little chores if the old woman was tended to by someone else. Effie pointed out that even the Queen has an Indian servant, and since Mary was often tired of Lady Hathaway's endless stories of life in India, she thought someone from there would provide her a more willing ear. She was easy to persuade, and Effie put me forward as a candidate. How did she explain knowing you? I ventured. Anjali smiled. She gave me a different surname, and said I had been a poor scholarship student at school, so that no one at the hall would connect my name with my grandmother's. I came to stay at Hathaway Hall, lightly disguised, so I would not be recognized leaving London. She shifted her head, and her hair gleamed in the lamplight. After that, Effie began to work on Mary Hathaway, very subtly, you understand, asking her grandmother to tell the story of the jewels so that Mary would hear of them. And because she is acquisitive and grasping, Mary knew that she wanted them. They would complete the picture she is painting for herself of a society hostess of great grandeur. Effie played into this, telling Mary that she ought to be painted in them, and suggesting to Charles that he commission such a painting for Mary. That would have worked, I believe, were it not for the return of Jonathan Hathaway. Her lips compressed into a thin line as she paused, and the Maharani spoke. It grows late, and there is still much to tell. Let us ring for refreshments, she suggested. We did as we were told, and in a very few minutes the Maharani's maid emerged from another room with platters of seed cakes and pots of tea flavoured with spices and rich with milk and sugar. The Maharani sat back, holding her glass of tea, and gestured towards her granddaughter.
You may continue.
Anjali bowed her head towards her grandmother. We realized if the diamond went missing but no one in the house left, then the house would be searched. So we hatched a clever plot to get the diamond out whilst we remained inside.
Clever?
The Maharani gave her granddaughter an exasperated look.
It was the scheme of melodramatic children.
The ghost, I said. I slanted a look at Lord Bhairav. I presume that is the role you played? He grinned, baring teeth as beautiful as his sister's.
I made a very good ghost,
he said, raising his arms into a menacing stance.
Were you not frightened by my spectral ball of light?
No, I told him calmly,
But you terrorized the villagers to no end. He shrugged.
I gave them a good story to raise their hairs. They will talk of it for generations. Can you guess how I did it? A glass ball with galvanic effects?
Stoker guessed.
Carried against a black robe so it would appear to be floating in midair? Exactly right,
Lord Bhairav said.
But the construction of the orb was Anjali's doing,
he added, with apparent pride in his sister.
Of course, I exclaimed, turning to Anjali. We spoke at length about Galvani and Volta when I visited the observatory. But your interest is not merely theoretical, is it?
My scientific studies, she said modestly. My speciality is electrical fields. Bhairav and I had to meet occasionally to discuss matters, and I could not always get away at convenient times. And, of course, she added with a wry smile, we did not want the villagers to note a man of Indian appearance upon the moors. So we met at night, a treacherous proposition for him, since the moorland is full of dangers. I developed the orb as a sort of lantern to guide his way across the moors, but also to frighten the local folk should they see him. We could not risk anyone seeing him close and asking questions. Another piece of the puzzle slotted neatly into place. You stayed with Nanny Burnham in her cottage on the moor, did you not? I asked Lord Bhairav. I heard someone moving about when I called upon her. She told me it was the cat, but the cat was sleeping on the hearth. Nanny Burnham was forcibly retired by Mary Hathaway, Anjali volunteered. Not refined enough to teach her children, she said. So it was not hard for Effie to persuade Nanny Burnham to help us. All she need do was give Bhairav a place to stay hid during the day. His only problem was Nanny Burnham's cooking, Anjali added, with a glance at her brother's slender midsection. He ate too much of her nursery fare and was growing fat. He grinned and patted his belly.
Nanny Burnham made a very delicious rice pudding and something called a jam roly-poly. Damson jam?
Stoker asked hopefully.
Raspberry,
Lord Bhairav told him.
Even better.
Stoker's expression was wistful. His fondness for natural science was rivaled only by his fondness for nursery foods. At long last, Anjali said, picking up the thread of the conversation, the Eye of the Dawn was retrieved from the bank vault, and the time was at hand. Effie broke into the casket and took it, leaving behind a handkerchief marked with Jonathan Hathaway's initials.
In order to implicate me.
Harry volunteered. Anjali shrugged. Anything to bring confusion to the matter would serve our purposes. Within the family, there was dissension as to whether you really were Jonathan Hathaway. If Jonathan's handkerchief were found, apparently dropped during the theft, then it was a certainty that Charles would insist upon a search of the house. But the diamond would not be there. It would have vanished into thin air, she said, fluttering her fingers. But everyone in the house would have lived under suspicion, most of all you, I pointed out. I was never going to stay, she replied, a few days to let them search my things and find nothing. Then I would quietly disappear, remove my disguise and become myself again. And if anyone decided to circulate your description, they would be looking for someone considerably older, I finished. It would appear you thought of everything.
Except that without a clear resolution to the crime, without a proper solution, the atmosphere would have become poisonous.
Stoker objected.
Everyone would have been under suspicion, always wondering who might have taken it.
And Charlie shrugged again. That is what I told Effie, but she did not care. She is very, very angry, with all of them, even Lady Hathaway. No one in that house understands or cares about her feelings, so why should she care about theirs? I deplore her actions, but I also comprehend them, I told her. It is diabolical to set out to create an atmosphere of disharmony, of actual malice, within a household. But that is more Mary Hathaway's doing than Effie's. Charles has permitted it, and Lady Hathaway is too old and infirm to make an objection, even if she wished. I am not surprised you understand, Anjali said. She met my gaze with her own, level and without judgment.
Effie Hathaway has a far twistier mind than I suspected, Harry said, in a tone of grudging admiration.
Effie knew suspicion would fall, but she must have known it would always fall hardest upon Anjali, Jonathan, that is you, Harry, and herself. Lady Hathaway would have no cause to steal her own jewel, and Charles and Mary would never suspect one another. And by causing a search to take place, it would clear the rest of the staff, ensuring they were not touched by her revenge upon her family.
And I might have swung for it with no consideration from her, Harry said, turning slightly green.
Hanging, I am informed, is no longer the penalty in this country for theft,
the Maharani said, by way of consolation.
Have another seed cake, she urged.
He shoved it into his mouth, still looking darkly at Anjali. I was rather impressed by the ruthlessness of the plot, but not surprised. There are few people on earth more capable of hatred than the female sex when caged.
So she plotted a course for restitution,
Stoker summed up. I looked from the Maharani to her grandchildren and shook my head. It was indeed restitution for the theft committed so long ago, but this was about much more than that. I know you have the diamond, and to you a wrong has been righted, but Effie was not driven by a desire to expiate the crimes of her family against yours. She has struck out against them as a tigress will turn on its tamer. I addressed the Maharani. She does not seek to benefit you, Your Excellency. She seeks to wound them. The Maharani nodded.
Of course, this is true. But I also do not care.
You were content to take advantage of a young woman's misery? I asked sharply.
Yes, she said, without apology. I have what I wanted, what justice required. No blood was shed, so I consider that a victory, Miss Speedwell.
She turned to Anjali.
Finish the story, child.
Anjali went on. Effie took the diamond and wrapped it into a piece of oilcloth. She passed that to me, and I went out to the summer house, where I was supposed to meet Bhairav to hand the jewel to him. It was essential this happen as quickly as possible, because we did not know when Lady Hathaway would realize it had been stolen, and the diamond must be out of the house before the cry was raised. But before you could hand it over, I appeared, I put in. She smiled thinly.
I was not pleased to see you, Miss Speedwell.
Nor was I,
Lord Bhairav said in a fervent voice.
I tripped twice over those abominable robes trying to get away from you.
Anjali picked up the thread of her narrative. There was no time to think.
so I shoved the jewel into the watering pot in the summer house and pretended to faint.
Why the watering pot?
Harry asked.
Because if the hall were searched and it were found there, it would implicate no one in particular,
Stoker guessed. Anjali nodded. It was an imperfect solution, but it was the best I could do under the circumstances. I had to stop Miss Speedwell from discovering Bhairav. Feigning unconsciousness would delay her pursuit of him and allow him time to get away. But there was no place to conceal the diamond on my person. If she found it, all would be lost.
The best of a bad situation,
Stoker agreed. How did the orb vanish? I asked. He grinned.
I shoved it into my robes to conceal the light until I was on the far side of a boulder. Then I hurried away, back to the safety of Nanny Burnham's cottage. I dressed in my own clothes and was waiting for some message from Anjali. Nanny Burnham's cat came in with a shrew, a messy thing,
he added with a moo of distaste.
I took it outside to throw it in the midden when I saw a figure in the moonlight crossing the moor. It was the man calling himself Jonathan Hathaway,
he said, with a gesture towards Harry.
I thought it curious he would be out so late, and I followed him. He went to the station and caught the first train to London. I did also, although I cannot say I was driven by anything other than instinct. He acted furtive, suspicious, and I wondered if he had something to do with the reason Anjali had not been able to hand over the jewel. I was prepared to follow him and see where he went, but no sooner had he alighted in London than he was taken. Abducted, really, by a tall man with very blonde hair and a woman in a veil.
We are familiar,
Stoker said dryly.
You saw them snatch me and did nothing to help?
Harry demanded.
I was kidnapped, you know. A rescue would not have gone amiss, my good fellow.
Lord Bhairav gave him a lofty look.
It is not my purpose to involve myself in the domestic matters of Englishmen. Besides, they were suspicious and very watchful. I had to keep well back so they did not see me, and in my efforts to remain discreet, I lost them. I returned here and sent a telegram to Nanny Burnham for Anjali to collect. We used a sort of code, and through that, Anjali was able to respond.
His sister picked up the story. It was Effie who hit upon the idea of how to get the diamond out of the house by secreting it in the orrery. I found your address on the letter in Charles Hathaway's desk and cabled it here to Bhairav with instructions to retrieve it as soon as you had returned to London. Which he almost did, she added, a touch of asperity spicing her words. Her brother flared.
I would have managed it if it were not for the dogs,
he protested.
So many dogs.
There are rather a lot, I consoled him. When he failed to retrieve it, Anjali went on, I decided to come myself. I thought I could pay a call upon you and perhaps manage to take it. I would have thought of something. I turned to the Maharani again. Did you know about the scheme to retrieve the diamond? She pressed her lips together in an expression of disapproval, but I had a sense she was not entirely displeased.
Not at first. Anjali was supposed to be staying at the hall as the guest of her school friend, and Bhairav was meant to join her for a visit. It was not until I announced my intention to come to London that Bhairav broke down and told me the truth.
She looked complacently from one grandchild to the next. I am exasperated with their flair for melodrama, but a sense of theatricality is not the worst thing
if one means to spend one's life in politics. What now? I asked Anjali. Will you give up your studies into galvanism? One of the best ways for India to demonstrate her worth is to develop new technologies and means of production, she said coolly. There is nothing more political than the ability to take care of one's own people. The Maharani rose smoothly, and the rest of us followed suit. She shook hands with Harry.
I believe your motives were not good, and I think your character is entirely defective, but that is not our affair. On behalf of my family, I apologize for any inconvenience you may have suffered.
He gaped, but recovered his composure swiftly.
Thank you, Your Excellency, he murmured.
She extended her hand to Stoker.
Mr. Templeton Vane.
Stoker kissed her hand, and she moved to me.
Miss Speedwell.
Her mouth twitched a little.
I recognize in you a similar spirit to my granddaughter. I think you might well have become friends under a different set of circumstances.
I hope, if it is not too presumptuous, she might consider me one now, I said. Anjali smiled and shook my hand. Goodbye, Miss Speedwell. Anjali even shook hands with Harry, who had the grace to look abashed.
I am sorry if I distressed Effie. She is a nice girl, all things considered, and I hope she did not take it too hard.
Anjali laughed. Effie? She never believed you for a second. She is the only one who knew the moment you arrived that you could not be Jonathan. He stared at her in astonishment.
But how?
Ask her yourself, she said, lifting her chin. I am finished answering the questions of Englishmen. We left, collecting a wide-eyed JJ from the foyer as we went. We hurtled down the stairs, and she whisked us into the linen closet again. She scribbled notes on her cuff until Stoker gently plucked the pencil from her grasp.
You cannot write any of it,
he reminded her. Blast and damnation, she began. But we have something better for you, I promised her. Come tomorrow for tea, and we will tell you everything you want to know about a fiendish villainess who swindled thousands out of the cream of Brazilian nobility. Her eyes widened, and she looked at each of us in turn. Harry gave her a miserable sigh.
Very well. Yes. Come to tea, and I will tell you whatever you want to know. Print it all.
JJ tweaked his moustaches and sent us on our way. As we settled into a hackney for the drive back to Bishop's Folly, I felt oddly deflated. I do not like it, I said, my brow furrowing.
What? The mystery of the ghostly light on the moor is solved, the diamond has been returned to its rightful owner. And Harry Spenlove will soon be taking his leave of you,
Harry put in lightly. But Effie Hathaway is still at the mercy of a family who respect neither her abilities nor her ambitions, I protested.
She has got the last laugh,
Stoker reminded me.
She carried out a criminal enterprise under their noses. Rather too well,
Harry protested.
I might have done hard labour because of that little harridan.
She is unhappy, I said simply, and she is likely to be for the rest of her life. Stoker and Harry and I were still gently bickering about Effie Hathaway when we returned to the Belvedere. There was a strange sense of unfinished business about the whole matter, I decided, and it seemed odd to realise how much had happened in only a few short days.
Shall we sleep here again tonight?
Harry suggested.
There was something boyishly hopeful in his tone, and when I looked at him, he blushed a little.
It's just that I mean to leave by tomorrow night. The longer I stay, the likelier that Isabel will find me, and I'd just as soon not have that happen. And spending the night here felt matey, he finished. I haven't had that in a while, you know.
I looked at Stoker, who shrugged.
I will fetch the aguardiente, I said.
We took a bottle of the heady stuff to the snuggery, where we settled in with the dogs. It was both reward for the successful conclusion of an investigation and anaesthetic for our various injuries. Bruises and swelling had begun to set in, and we were soon nodding over our cups. Some time after the clocks chimed two, I felt someone tuck a blanket over me, and I drifted for a long while until I heard Stoker's voice, a low, soft rumble in the darkness.
Do you really think of her as the Eurydice to your Orpheus?
Sometimes, Harry said on a sigh. She is a difficult woman to forget. The mistake you made was in thinking she was a bit player in your story,
Stoker told him.
She is mistress of her own fate, and she bends to no man.
Not even you?
A laugh in the darkness that was not entirely mirthful.
Sometimes I think, especially not me.
They fell to silence then, and in a few minutes I heard Harry's quiet snores and Stoker's deep, even breaths. They slept, but long into the night I lay wakeful, thinking of what they said.